get to them, gracebiblechurch.org. And no other way. Don't use another means to try to get to them. You'll get somewhere else. GraceBibleChurch.org will get you to the homepage, and there's a link there called Learning. Click on that link, and it'll get you to all the Sunday school lessons that are out there. This one and numerous other ones if you care to listen to them as well. Okay, we have been looking at some events in the life of Samuel, most recently here in our study. And Samuel was a judge. He's the last of the judges. There were like 12 before him. Number varies a tad depending on whether you include some small items and things of that sort. But let's just say there's 12 before him. And he's the last one. And judges were people that God raised up at times when needed by the nation Israel to help them, to do things for them, to usually save them from their enemies. And he's the last one in the line of them. And he's going to kind of bridge the nation over to the monarchy, to the kingdoms, beginning with Saul and going on to David and then Solomon and all the different people that came from the divided kingdom. So he's the last of that group of people that fulfilled that particular role, God's theocratic administrator, judging the nations and trying to administrate justice on their behalf. Now, when we left off last week, there was a conflict taking place between the Philistines, Israel's kind of persistent enemy, and Israel. And this is like the 12 cycles before them. That is, they were oppressed by some kind of opposing enemy, and God rose up a judge to help them, and so on. And the Philistines are located down here in this southwestern quadrant of Israel. There's five cities here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay? Those five cities comprise the Philistine nation. Each city had they called them a lord. And taken collectively, they were the Philistine nation. And they bugged Israel every chance they got. They're always fighting, trying to take over some of their land and things of that sort. And they've been in conflict most recently here in our study. And the last conflict that they had together was summarized by a messenger from the battle like this. This is verse 17 of chapter 4. The one who brought the news answered and said, Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there's also been a great slaughter among the people. And your two sons, this guy's talking to Eli here, the high priest, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God has been taken. A bad, bad summary of that battle. Israel was on the short end of that stick. They lost that battle and that conflict, and things went badly for them. And the Philistines captured the symbol of God's presence. They captured that box that sat in the temple where God met with them. And the Philistines now have that in their possession. So pick up the trail here in chapter 5, verse 1. So the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. That's one of their cities here. So they bring it from the battle up there down here to one of their cities. So the Philistines have now got the Ark of the Covenant, and they've taken it to one of their cities. The symbol of God's presence. Now, the way these kings would do back at this time, of course, is that when they defeated a people, they would try to take some sort of artifacts or symbols of that people's God and take it into their area to say, in effect, to show, in effect, hey, our God's better than your God, and we just whipped you because our God's better than your God. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar sacked Jerusalem, he took the articles that they used in worship down to Babylon. Yeah, Bob?
You know, the term Ebenezer, is it used other than just for the name of a city?
Well, it's probably used of some person, but it's actually two different cities go by the same name. One, there was a loss there, which is the one that they're referring to there where they took the ark. And in another one, they're going to name the place Ebenezer after a victory. So same name, one applied to a loss and one applied to a victory in battle.
Well, there's something in a song about my Ebenezer or something like that.
Maybe they're a site of a loss or their site of a victory or a symbol of a loss or a symbol of a victory, maybe. I don't know the song you're referring to, but it may be how they're using it. Okay. So, Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing. He took those cups and all that worshiping stuff and took it down to Babylon to demonstrate that, hey, my God is better and greater than your God. And so that's what they're doing here. They brought the ark down to their place, and they took the ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon. That's their chief god. And set it by Dagon. So they brought the ark in and set it before a statue of their god. His name is Dagon. He was sort of the grain god or the agricultural god of the Philistines. And so they've taken the ark and set it there in front of him. And when the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him up in his place again. Well, that didn't work out real well, did it? Their God is eating dirt in front of the Hebrews' God, or a box representing his presence. So, that doesn't bode real well for the Philistines, does it? So they set him up. But when they rose early the next morning, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off, and on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. The second day, poor old Dagon comes up even shorter. He not only is knocked over again, now his hands and head are gone. They're cut off, and they're actually laying on the doorway into this place that he's kept. Now, if the purpose of putting the ark beside him was to demonstrate the superiority of their God to the Hebrew God, how's that working out? Not too well so far. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. So they wouldn't walk across that doorway anymore since their wonderful God's heads and hands were piled there as a result of this maneuver they pulled off here. And the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. Whoa, the hand of the Lord was heavy. I thought this was a military conflict. I thought these were armies kind of battling out with one another. How come all of a sudden God has stepped into the middle of this fight? And he's whipping up on them pretty good, isn't he? What's he using? Is he using a standing army of Israel to combat them in this situation here? What's he using? Tumors. He's using disease. God is not using a military army to whip up on the Philistines. He's using a disease. I didn't know he could do that. I thought he'd have to have an army to fight an army. There are a lot of elements in our society and probably others in this world who deny that God uses disease to judge and punish sin. A lot of people don't like that concept, and they try to deny it. But you can't read this book and deny that principle, because there are example after example after example of God using diseases to punish the sin of men. So deny it all you want, it is undeniable. He's doing it right here. And this particular disease involves tumors of some kind. He ravaged them and he smote them with these. And when the men of Ashdod saw that it was so bad, or that it was so, they said, the ark of God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon, our God. They recognize this punishment as being from God. They see now, whoa, all of a sudden, his symbol of his presence is right here with our God, and all of a sudden everything is turned off bad. We're being struck by these tumors from this particular disease, and it's coming from him. They recognize that. So they sent and they gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them and said, that would be the five city leaders, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they said, let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath. And they brought the ark of God of Israel around. So they say, hey, I know what, let's get it out of here and give it to one of our other cities. Let those guys take care of it. So let's take it from here over to here. Now these guys must not have gotten a memo to let that thing come into their territory. But they did. And it came about that after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city and very great confusion. He smote the men of the city, both young and old, so the tumors broke out on them. So Gad is getting the exact same treatment that Ashdod got. Not a military conflict, but one of God's other, many other tools of judgment that he can use. A disease. And they get blasted with it also. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. So get it out of here and take it up to Ekron. See the city just up north here? Get it out of here and take it up here. So these northern cities are all trying to get this thing away from them.
Why didn't they set fire to it?
Beg your pardon?
Why didn't they set fire to it?
Why didn't they do what?
Set fire to it.
Set fire to it? Mm-hmm. They probably were afraid to. These guys have got the good sense to recognize that this is a symbol of the presence of the God of their enemies. And they probably would be afraid to do that since they see him bringing a judgment down upon them, would be my guess, maybe. So they try to send it on up to Ekron, the third stop on the tour. And it happened that the ark of God came to Ekron. The Ekronites cried out, saying, they brought the ark of the God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people. Everybody's scared to death of this thing now. They sent, therefore, and gathered all the gods of the Philistines and said, send away the ark of God of Israel and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people. For there was deadly confusion throughout the city, and the hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were smitten with the tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. Sometimes the spoils of war aren't quite worth it, are they? Yeah. These guys were the winners. They get the ark, and look what's happened to them. They're just getting hammered city after city after city, not by a standing army, but by a disease that God is using to judge men. Kind of hard to deny that God uses disease, isn't it? But people do it all the time. Bob?
Well, you can't help but think about COVID.
Well, there are diseases, of course, that judge men in general, and that's going to be one of the, God's got four main means of judging men that we see in Ezekiel 14, and disease is one of them. COVID could be an example of that type of thing. And there will be more of that, I think, before all is said and done. This particular disease, however, is focused specifically upon these people, these Philistines, because of their conflict with Israel. And instead of using an army to judge them, he's just using a disease. So, does God have to have an army?
Is it always assumed that the Ten Commandments are in the ark?
Well, for people who knew what was in it, that would be true. Now, these guys have heard a lot about the Exodus and events around the Exodus. So they may think there's something there. I don't know if they know the three items are all there exactly just yet, but that's probably generally known among not only the Hebrews, but their enemies as well, as we'll see a little more of here as we go along. So, I keep emphasizing the fact that God is not using a standing army. Does he have to use a standing army to protect his people? No, doesn't have to. He didn't do it here. He just used something else. All right, chapter 6. Now, the Ark of the Lord had been in the country of the Philistines 7 months. So somehow or another they bore up under it, living with those tumors and whatever else they had there. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners, saying, "What shall we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us how we shall send it to its place." They want to get it out of their territory. How do they do this? They ask their soothsayers and their diviners and all that stuff. And he said, "Well, if you send away the Ark of God of Israel, do not send it empty, but you shall surely return it to him a guilt offering. And you shall be healed, and it shall be known to you why his hand is not removed from you." So he said, "Well, if we send it back, we need to send it with it a guilt offering. We need to admit our offense here and send something back with the Ark." And that would have been a proper thing to do amongst these kinds of pagans and so on at this time. So they said, "Well, what should we send? What shall be the guilt offering, which we shall return to him?" And they said, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for one plague was on all of you and all on all your lords." Now, the objects that they choose to send with the ark going back is a replica of a tumor and a replica of a mouse or a rat. Now, the fact that rats have now been introduced into this scene makes a lot of people think, well, maybe this was the bubonic plague. Maybe. The bubonic plague, however, was actually transmitted by fleas on rats, not the rats. It's the fleas that bit people that transmitted the virus, not the rats. The rats were just their ride. That's how they got around. So the fleas were actually the culprit with the bubonic plague, and the bubonic plague typically attacked the lymph system, caused it to swell up and cause all kinds of problems rather than tumors. So maybe that's what this is, but maybe not. Maybe it's just something else. Who knows? But they think, apparently, that the rats are instrumental in the transmission of this thing, whether it was rat bites or fleas, whatever. So they think, well, what we'll do is we'll send a replicant of those items, tumors and the rats, and put them in there. So whatever it is, those two items symbolize it, and that's what they're going to put in there. So you shall, verse 5, "So you shall make likenesses of your tumors and likenesses of your mice that ravage the land." Might have been leprosy. Could have been a form of leprosy back at that time too. Who knows? "And you shall give glory to the God of Israel." Now look at their understanding of the relationship of Israel's God to them and their problem. They recognize, these pagans, these Philistine pagans, recognize the appropriateness of giving glory to their enemy's God who has done this to them. They realize they're having their lunch is being eaten by him, and they accept and recognize that he is due glory associated with this happening. They seem to show greater wisdom in the relationship to God than the Hebrews show, these pagan Philistines. "Perhaps he will ease his hand from you, your gods, and your land." So that's the counsel of the diviners and so on from the Philistines, is to send this thing back with a guilt offering in hopes that God will be appeased by this, by our recognition that he deserves to be glorified, and maybe he'll cut us some slack. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened theirs? You see, Mike, they know the history. They know how the Egyptians behaved before God and his plagues, that they hardened their hearts. So they've learned that somehow, these Philistines have. They're saying, let's don't make the same mistakes the silly Egyptians made and harden our hearts against him. Let's give him the glory that is due him and seek some kind of mercy from him, perhaps. When he had severely dealt with them, they did not allow the people to go, and they departed. So ultimately, their hardening of their hearts didn't help anyway. They left anyway. The Hebrews left Egypt anyway. So the Philistines know this history, and they're responding with some fairly good wisdom coming from pagan peoples. So here's their plan. So take and prepare a new cart and two milch cows on which there has never been a yoke. Hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves home away from them. Now these would be two cows who have just recently had calves. So the cows are producing milk and it needs to be removed each day by nursing the cows. And the cows need to be nursed. Take these two cows that have these new calves whose motherly instincts would be to go to the calves and nurse them and put a yoke on them, which they've never worked as a yoked team before. They don't know how to do that. So that one's going to try to go this way and one's going to try to go that way to get to their calves. So they ain't going to function well in a yoke. That's just like nothing but locking them together. They won't pull in one direction properly if they're doing this naturally. And take their calves and lock them up at home. Take the Ark of the Lord, place it on the cart, put the articles of gold which you return to him as a guilt offering in a box by its side, then send it away that it may go. So set up this situation that if everything is just happening naturally, what will transpire is that the cows will try to get back to their calves. One will go one way, one will go the other. The yoke won't work. Everything will just be understood by natural functioning of cows trying to nurse their calves, if that's just the way things have happened. And watch, if it goes up the way of its own territory to Beth Shemesh, then he has done us this great evil. On the other hand, if these cows march over to here, back into the Israelites' territory, to this city, then clearly that's God at work. So if everything is explainable by natural behavior on the part of the cows, then God had nothing to do with this. On the other hand, if these two cows leave their calves behind, function under the yoke, and walk back to this city in Israeli territory, clearly that's the hand of God at work. So you see the pro and con of the deal here, how they've set this up? This will indicate to them who has actually done this. So they did. They put that plan together, hooked the cows up, shut the cows up at home, put the Ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the likeness of their tumors. And the cows took the straight way in the direction of Beth Shemesh. Clearly, this is God at work, right? That's the indicator they're looking for. The cows marched just from where they were over to here in an orderly manner. So clearly this is the hand of God on them. If they hadn't, they would have said, this disease that befell us was just a coinkydink and we'll get past it and everything will go back to normal. But it wasn't. The cows indicate very clearly this is God's hand at work. So they head down the highway toward Beth Shemesh, lowing as they went. They did not turn aside to the right or to the left, and the Lord of the Philistines followed them to the border of Beth Shemesh. So they follow along behind them to the edge of town here, and they see this happening, and they're thinking, oh my gosh, clearly this is God at work. Can't deny that. And the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and they raised their eyes and saw the ark and were glad to see it. So the Hebrews, when they see the ark coming back into their territory, they're delighted. They're happy to see the cows pulling the cart, bringing the ark back to them. So verse 14, the cart came into the field of Joshua the Beth Shemite and stood there where there was a large stone. And they split the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. Well, the cows may be wishing now they'd gone the other way, huh? But they take the wood from the cart. And by the way, what's wrong with this offering? This is a burnt offering. And they use the cows. What's wrong with that? The cows are the wrong gender. The burnt offering had to be a male animal, not female. So they kind of miss the boat there a tad, but their intent seems to be good. It looks like they're trying to offer a thanksgiving to the Lord for bringing it back and all that. So they use what they got there. They use the two cows. But Leviticus 1:3, the burnt offering was a male animal. And the Levites took down the Lord of the ark. This is a Beth Shemesh is a Levitical city. They're scattered all over the place. Remember, they didn't have lands or any way of making a living on their own. So they were just scattered throughout the land in various cities to serve God as Levites. That was one of the cities right there. So the people receiving the ark, they surely knew that they shouldn't use female cows, but they did it anyway. But they're happy to have it. And they take the ark and the articles there, and they put them on that large stone. And they offered burnt offerings and sacrifices that day to the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned to Ekron that day. So the Philistines finally managed to get the ark out of their territory and back into the hands of Israel. So for a while, they didn't even have the ark. But they got it back. It wasn't gone that long. And it stays in that area now for some time until David actually moves it to Jerusalem. So it started up there at Shiloh, up there, kind of did a loop down through the land of the Philistines and back into Israel's territory, where it would remain now for a number of years, about 40 or 50 years, I think, before David moved it. So all of this scene, everything going on here, does not involve a standing army. It does not involve military conquests. It involves the working of God in whatever way he so chooses, and he has protected the interests of the Israeli people and gotten that ark back. And these are the golden tumors which the Philistines returned for a guilt offering to the Lord, one for Ashdod, one for Gaza, Eklon, Gath, and Ekron. That's their five cities. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both of 4 to 5 cities and of countries, villages, large stone on which they set the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua the Beth Shemite. So supposedly that large stone is still there today. Anybody ever seen this? Anybody been there and saw what they said was this memorial stone? Maybe it's here today, maybe it ain't, I don't know. So, things worked out, didn't they? Verse 19, and he struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck down all of the people, 50,070 men. Does your Bible say that? 50,070? Does anybody's Bible just say 70? Yeah, some do, some don't. Yeah, there's a debate about that number. 50,070 men for a little city out here in the middle of nowhere is a little bit strong, isn't it? There may be a textual problem there. It may just been 70. It doesn't matter. The point is that some people mucked around with this ark when they weren't supposed to, because they looked into it. If they didn't know what was in it by this time, Mike, they shouldn't have looked. They should have went and read a book somewhere and gotten the idea. Peeking in this ark was a no-no. You didn't do that. And yet some of them did. And you would think these Levites would have pounced on this thing and make sure it was well protected and cared for immediately and not let people go up there and start cracking the lid open and looking inside. So a bunch of people were struck down because of that. Let's say 70. I don't know what the truth is there, but at any rate, the Lord struck the people with a great slaughter. Now, that doesn't 70 doesn't sound so much like a great slaughter. The other number does, so who knows? We'll leave that one in the unknown column for a while. And the men of Beth Shemesh said, well, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? To whom shall we go up for us? And to whom shall he go up from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, the Philistines have brought back the ark to the Lord. Come down and take it up to you. And the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated this guy, Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. They actually assigned a guy to watch this thing, and he did. It came about from the day that the ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim in time he was long, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. So they moved it up to there, not Beth Shemesh. They moved it up to Kiriath-Jearim and kept it there until David moved it later. So everything has kind of come out okay here now. The ark is brought back. It's clearly in the environs of Israel. Their enemy is not a problem for them right now, and things are looking okay. So God is at work on their behalf. He's used something unconventional to warfare. He used a disease instead of an army. But he has nevertheless produced the final result that they needed. So Samuel now steps into the scene, and he spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. What is the problem that Israel is having that Samuel is trying to correct here? It's the same problem they've had for the last 400 years since they left Egypt. It's idolatry. They still have idols in their possession, and they still are worshiping idols. They were told to get rid of all of those at the time of the Exodus. But they still have them in their midst. And Samuel then is calling them to repentance from their idolatry as a condition for God delivering them from their enemies. Their security as a people is dependent upon changing of their mind about idolatry, repentance. He says, if you will do that, you get rid of these idols that you are still embracing, then God will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. Not me, Samuel, not some other person, but God will deliver you from your enemies. Your security rests in his hands. That's the condition. So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth and served the Lord alone. So they did respond. They did repent. This besetting sin plagued them all of their existence. They would go through these cycles of repentance and obedience and resulting peace and security, and then succumb right back to it and start it up again. Over and over and over for the next 300 years following Joshua's death, it was one cycle after the other. That's the cycle of the 12 judges. Every one of them was the same. They would succumb to idolatry. God would send an oppressive people, enemies of theirs, like the Philistines or some of the other people around them. They would cry out to God. He would have mercy on them. He'd raise up a judge who would deliver them from their enemies, and they would enjoy peace for the next 30 or 40 or 50 years. Then they would do the exact same thing over again. Over and over and over. And that's the whole cycle of the period of the judges. Is that cycle repeated at least 12 different times, and here a 13th time with Samuel involved? So Samuel says to them in verse 5, "Gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I'll pray to the Lord for you." Was that on that map, Mizpah? I don't see it. It's on this map. Let's look at this one for a little bit. Okay, Mizpah is right here, kind of in the middle of Samuel's route. So he says, "Get everybody up there, and we're going to have a big meeting." And they gathered to Mizpah, and they drew water and poured it out before the Lord, and they fasted on that day. Apparently, these are two symbols of repentance. The pouring out of water is a symbol of God's providing water for them, as he did during their wilderness wanderings. And the fasting, another gesture symbolic of God's providing food for them, as he did with the manna and so on. So apparently these two acts of repentance will help lead them to dependence on God. "And they admitted that we have sinned against the Lord, and Samuel judged the sons of Israel at Mizpah." Now, when the Philistines heard that the sons of Israel had gathered at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And the sons of Israel heard it, and they were afraid of the Philistines. So these nasty old Philistines, when they recognize that Israel is gathering together there at Mizpah, they probably feel threatened that maybe Israel's putting together an army to attack them. So they get ready to attack Israel while they're up there repenting before God and worshiping Him. "So the sons of Israel said to Samuel, 'Do not cease to cry to the Lord our God for us, that He may save us from the hand of the Philistines.'" Now the people have, at least in this particular instance, the good sense to realize their source of security and protection and help is God. So they ask Samuel to intervene on their behalf and to continually pray to God for that deliverance. So Samuel took a suckling lamb and he offered it for a whole burnt offering to the Lord. Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. So Samuel is their intermediary, intervenes on their behalf before God, offers up this offering. Now Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day against the Philistines and confused them so that they were routed before Israel. Once again, the military conflict seems to be totally altered by God. And as the Philistines are preparing for battle, he thunders against them in some way. Some sort of an audible sound that just scared the daylights out of them. They go into total confusion, and Israel routs them that day. They asked for God's protection and help. He gave it to them. And the sons of the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them down as far as below Beth-Kar. That one's not on there. I don't know where that is. Sounds like maybe it's to the south. But what's happening, as you can see, is that the Israelites are routing the Philistines because God intervened once again. He intervened earlier to get the ark back. He's intervening now to put this Philistine army into chaos. So Samuel took a stone, set it between Mizpah and Shin, and named it Ebenezer. There's another one, Mike, saying, "Thus far the Lord has helped us." Remember, one of the battles was at Ebenezer where Israel got mopped up on. Here, Israel mopped up on the Philistines, and it's named the same thing. It means the stone of God. It's just a marker, basically, what it means. So the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come any more within the border of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. How is it working out for the Israelites to have God working for them? It's working out pretty good, isn't it? The Israelites are successful in defeating their enemies with God working for them, doing something for them. He didn't use a standing army. He used a disease in one case. He used this thundering sound in another case. I don't know exactly what it was. But something caused them to fall apart, the Philistines to fall apart. And so he delivered them from their enemies all of the days of Samuel with no standing army. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron to Gath. And Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines, so there was space between Israel and the Amorites. That's a term that just refers in general to the Canaanites before them. So God delivered his people. They get their cities back that the Philistines had taken, and things worked out well. And Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And he used to go annually on circuit to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all these cities. Then he would return to Ramah, and that's where his house was. So Samuel kind of ministered primarily here in the central part of the country, right in through here, on a circuit. He would travel this circuit, judging the people and settling issues and taking care of things as he went all the days of his life. So that's kind of where he went. So let's just think about what we've seen here now. When the nation turned to God in repentance and followed him in obedience, everything worked out fine. It doesn't matter that Israel didn't have a standing army and their enemies did. It didn't matter. God brought about victory for them, didn't he? What kind of role is God playing there, do you think, in Israel's history at this point in time? Their security rests upon his authority and his power. Isn't that kind of basically the same role that a king plays? So isn't God doing a good job of being their king? They're winning. They're victorious. They were getting mopped up before. But all of a sudden, their king, who is a spiritual one, is bringing success after success to them. If you were an Israelite living during that time, what would you want by way of leadership? More of the same? I think I would. I said, God, keep on working, man. Whatever you want from me, I will do. I will give whatever. You're doing the job. You are our king. You're doing great. Let's keep trusting and relying on you. Doesn't work out that way, does it? They didn't want a spiritual king. They're seeing these enemies all around them everywhere they are. They've got a human king and a standing army, and they're eating our lunch from time to time. Let's us get one of those. We want a king like that. We want somebody who we can trust to take care of and provide our security as well. Even though they just saw demonstrated in several different ways there, the very hand of God at work as their king. But chapter 8 is a turning point. It is a pivot point in the history of Israel. They've never had a monarchy before. They've wanted one before. And they want one now, in spite of the fact that God has demonstrated that he is a better monarch than anybody else could be. But this is where it turns. Their history turns right here. It came about that when Samuel was old, that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Who told Samuel to appoint his sons as judges? Do judges have a familial line of succession? The previous 12 didn't have it. Where does he think he's getting one? Why does he think it's his duty to appoint his sons as succeeding him as judge of Israel? Nobody before had ever done that. And God hasn't told him to do that. Why is he doing that? I wonder what his motive is. Is this a money-making opportunity? Having your sons as judges, is being in the role of a judge a money-making opportunity that he wants to preserve for his sons? Why is he appointing his sons to a role that God has not told him to do? Joel and Abijah, they're judging down in Beersheba. They're down south. See where that is, way down here? Why is he doing this? Complicating the question is this. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. His sons were a couple crackheads. Their number one duty is to promote justice. And what are they doing? They're promoting injustice. They're taking bribes. They're in it for the money. Did he know that? Now, they're down south from him their ways. They're down in Beersheba. If he did not know that they were corrupt, that certainly tarnishes his heritage a little bit. He should know what his own sons are doing. Everybody else seems to know it but him.
What is his middle name, Cutter?
I think it might have been. And he got the nickname the Big Guy. If he did not know, that certainly tarnishes our legacy from Samuel somewhat. If he knew, that tarnishes it a lot more than somewhat. If he knew his sons were corrupt and he put them in these jobs anyway, not instructed by God to do so, unprecedented act on his part, what in the world is his motive? What is he trying to achieve on behalf of his sons if he knows they're corrupt and their only job is to promote justice? Something going on here. I'm not sure I understand it all, but I don't like what I'm seeing.
But that's the same thing as Mentor did. That's the same thing Eli did.
Yeah. Now, remember, Eli also, it cost his descendancy the priesthood. Not only their lives, but the priesthood. But the priesthood had a familial line of succession. Judges don't. So he's trying to introduce something that kind of locks up something for his sons that is not his to lock up. We don't know his motive. It's not told to us, so we're just guessing. We're just speculating. There's something about this picture, though, that ain't good. What's happening here is not good. Whatever it is. And furthermore, it only serves to exacerbate, to accelerate the desire on the part of the Jewish leadership for a king instead of him. Look what happens, verse 4. All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the other nations." Samuel, we don't want you. You're an old squirrel. You got one foot in the grave. We don't want you judging us. And we don't want your sons judging us because they're a bunch of crooks. We don't want anything about you, Samuel. Except we want you, as God's representative, to appoint a king over us to provide the basis for our security that we just saw God do himself. Now, Samuel wasn't real pleased at that request, verse 6. That thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." Basically, what they said to Samuel is, "Give us somebody to do your job, Samuel, because you ain't doing it. And we sure as heck don't want anything to do with those corrupt sons of yours." So don't say to us, well, my sons will take care of you. They'll judge you. They'll run the nation and you'll be okay. No, the leadership of the nation's got the good sense. The elders of the tribes have got the good sense to recognize Samuel ain't their guy going forward. And his sons certainly ain't their guy going forward. So they're asking him to appoint a king to serve over them and to provide the security that they think they need, but that God just told him he would provide for them, but that they're rejecting. And he's not happy with that. So he prays to God. What does he pray? Does he pray, God, can you believe these people? They think I'm unqualified to serve as their judge. Can you straighten them out for me? Or does he say, they should have accepted me as their judge? We're not told what he prays about. He seems to be taking the request as though they think he's chopped liver and they want nothing to do with him. So he prays to the Lord. And the Lord answered him in verse 7, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. God's response back to Samuel is, Samuel, don't take it so personal that they don't want anything to do with you. They don't want anything to do with me. I'm their king. I just demonstrated the inclination and the ability to provide security for them and take care of them, and they don't want me. It's not just that they don't want you. It's me they're rejecting. So go ahead and give them what they want. Now, if Samuel had not appointed his corrupt sons, would the leaders of the tribes have been so adamant in a request for somebody other than him? Maybe not. His poor judgment in appointing his corrupt sons as judges only furthers the desire on the part of the Jewish leadership to get somebody else, a king, instead of him. So he's part of the driver of this change in Jewish eschatology into a monarchy. And goes on to say, like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they're doing to you also. He says, Samuel, you're just seeing the same thing I've been watching for the past 400 years. They're doing the same thing to you, blowing you off and rejecting you just like they've done me since the time of the Exodus. So listen to them. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. Now, God is going to give them what they're asking for, but they need to understand how things are going to be. He told them back in Deuteronomy that they would, or Moses actually told them that they would one day ask for a king and they would get it, but it would be a king of God's choosing, not their own. But we'll see how that works out. So, the scene is now set wherein the leadership of the nation have asked God, asked Samuel to ask God, to appoint them a king. And God told him, go ahead and do it, Samuel. Give them what they're asking for. Father knows best, but they think they know best. So we'll give them what they are asking for, but warn them first what they're getting into. And we'll get into that next time. We'll ask, we'll see what that warning includes next time. So you understand the scene now. God has demonstrated his ability and willingness to serve as their king. They have rejected that and have asked for a human king in place of him. And God has agreed to give them what they want. And we'll see what that's about. And that will transition into Saul and in David and Solomon and 20 different guys in the north and 20 different guys in the south. on down through Israel's history. So the beginning of the monarchy is right here. It's this meeting in Mizpah and the request for a king on the part of the Jewish leadership. Questions or comments? Anything we saw here this morning? We're going to transition from judges to kings. As a result of this, Samuel is the last one of the judges, and it will be kings after that. What his motives were for appointing the judges, we can just talk about, we can guess about it, we can wonder about it. We don't know for sure because we're not told, but something is going on there, isn't there? That's such an abnormality that he's brought about there, that there's something in his thinking that may not be all that great and wonderful that's going to bring about the kingdom of Israel. Any questions or comments? Yeah, Carol?
Are all these Ites part of the Philistines?
Yes, those five cities are all...
And they're all considered...
They were all Philistine cities.
But they're all Amorites and...
No, the Amorites is just a term that's kind of like Canaanites. They were just the general residents of this area before. So what that verse is saying is that Israel was at peace with their neighbors during Samuel's days. Okay. The Philistines are just these five cities here. There's five of them. Taken collectively, they were the Philistines.
The Israelites were told they would die if they touched the ark, right?
Yes. Everybody was forbidden to touch it, but the Levites were permitted to transport it. That's why they had these rods down the side of it. They didn't touch the ark, picked up the rods, and they picked up the ark.
Did the Philistines then carry it by the rods?
They put it on that cart, remember? How they got it on the cart, I don't know.
Okay.
They probably touched it. But the warning was particularly for the Hebrews, whether or not God smote any Philistine that actually touched it. I'm not sure about that, but I wouldn't get near that thing.
Yeah.
If I was one of them, I'd be way back away from that thing. As the fools in the Raiders of the Lost Ark did.
Don,
yes.
I want to share something that kind of hit me after we studied this week, and that was when Hannah took Samuel to the temple. And I got to thinking, if I'd waited 10 years to have a child, and I'd made that vow with God or that promise, and then I realized what Eli and them were doing in the temple, I might have tried bargaining with God over that.
Yeah. Yeah, Hannah has quite a... Yeah, she shows a very faithful and committed resolve to that vow, doesn't she? And taking him up there and knowing his sons were worthless people and that influence would be in his home to some degree. What's that?
It was.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know they're counseling him to cheat and steal the meat and so on. Well, God just called him and used him in that way. See, he also used him as a prophet. Even as a young lad, he had him prophesy to Eli about the death of his sons and the loss of succession and all that sort of stuff. So Samuel actually fulfilled the role of judge, prophet, and he qualified as a priest. We just don't see him functioning that way that much, either. But he was really kind of all three.
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to be him and have to go to Eli either in our name
to David. Eli finished real bad, and Samuel is finishing... confusingly. Both of those men did not do well by their family. Why Samuel's children were so corrupt? Was he gone all the time? Is that the excuse for corrupted children, that you weren't at home enough to raise them? I don't know.
David made a lot of mistakes.
Beg your pardon?
David made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see a lot of failures in this book as we go on with people in their lives, but at any rate... Okay, I owe you 3 minutes from last week, and now I owe you 6 minutes. Okay, we'll let you roll, and we'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing. Hi, how you doing?
I got what happened at the end.
I beg your pardon?
I got what would happen at the end. Samuel.